Hi there. Welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate your time. Glad to have you along on this ride. And if you are looking for some information about near-death experiences, afterlife, that kind of thing, the consciousness, the connection we have with all that is, with everything beyond, with things we can't even describe or name or give voice to, you might want to listen to this interview a little closely. And there will be plenty of stuff to jump off in terms of talking points and questions and all that. If you have them, feel free to contact the author afterwards or get one of her numerous books. She's prolific. PMH Atwater. The book we have today is Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, and what they teach us about living, dying, and our true purpose. Hi, PMH Atwater. How are you?
Hi, and I'm fine.
I appreciate you taking time for this interview. I love your work, and I have been interested in this since, you know, since I have no age.
Forever, huh?
Yeah. You know, having gone through it a few times and being able to remember, that's kind of helpful. But not recently, thank you. And I think that what you have done with this book, I really, really applaud, because you've gone back and actually contradicted a few things that you had very strongly believed. So I want to ask, to start out with, your own experience, personally, do you think in some way, shape, or form that gave you any bias so that you would be more skeptical to hold that point of view? Is that a fair question?
It's a fair question. And I did everything I could to prevent bias. Even to the point of not ever talking about or linking back to my own experience when I was with other experiencers. In other words, I came in there. I'm a field worker, so mine is usually one-on-one or five-on-one or ten-on-one or, you know, always the personal. So I would come into the experience as a blank slate on which other people could write their experiences. So I did the best I could to be that objective, clear-minded person who simply was there, recorded what people said or how people acted, and then later on would do the best I could to look for patterns. Does this say anything? What am I seeing? You know, if I'm in the eastern states, like the new eastern states, is this same pattern in Kentucky and Tennessee? Is it in Minnesota? Is it in Florida? So I did a lot of bouncing around. At the time, I had a job where I traveled, so I could bounce around. And so I was always cross-checking, sometimes even by phone. And I did that over the years. I mean, we're not talking about a single project here. We're talking about a lifetime project almost, not the entire lifetime, but an ongoing project for 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nearly 4,000 adult and child experiencers. So I was always in there looking for what was real and what I could validate and what I could verify. And what were the overriding patterns, and also what were some of the details? And because I was one-on-one, and because, you know, I'm a cops kid, I was raised in a police station. My dad started teaching me police investigative techniques at the ripe old age of 9 years of age. Why, I don't know, but, you know, he did. And he would always say, the body says more than the mouth does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're watching the shoulders, the pupils of the eyes. Where do they put their weight when they walk? How do they respond to other people when they go by? What's happening with the joints in the body, the muscles, the skin tone, so forth and so on? So I'm always looking. You know, I never just interviewed anybody. I've always looked and listened and was there for them. So I come from that very different kind of space where I wasn't this typical scientist, and I'm using double-blind studies with a control group, and I'm sending out questionnaires, although over time I did send out three to double-check on, you know, findings I already made.
Mm-hmm.
So my work is basically just field work. You know, I'm just a cop's kid Some people have called me the gumshoe of near death. I mean, that's a fair term.
Well,
so I did everything I could to keep my own experience out of it.
Yeah, I like that. And you do point that out in the book, that even now when you're in at the end, you thank all of the people who didn't really know who you were. You kept that element out to prevent
right.
that kind of bias.
But you know, it's really kind of spooky, Wendy. You know, it didn't matter where I was. People would come up to me and start telling me about their near-death experience. And I finally decided that I must be wearing some kind of invisible sign that these people can see automatically and would know, here's someone I could tell, you know, my story to. Because, for instance, I was working a job in Kentucky. And when I say working a job, I worked for, Universal Communication System. And we would install these computerized switchboards, telephone boards in hotels and motels and businesses and this kind of thing. And I was working a job in either Kentucky or Tennessee. I think it was really Tennessee. And I was to train 10 people on this new computerized system, and 7 of them were near-death experiencers. 7 of them.
That's pretty impressive.
You know, they were right there. Or I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you know, and I hire this taxi cab to take me to the job site. He's an Egyptian. He's there on a special scholarship to go to college in Minneapolis. And we engage in a conversation. The next thing I know, he's telling me all about his near-death experience. Mm. So that's the way my life went for 33 years.
And I think there's a bigger reason for that. I do solidly believe there's a bigger reason. Do you have a bigger reason?
Well, I preferred not to think in those terms because that would in some way intrude on the research I was doing.
I understand.
But in the last few years, I have allowed myself those kind of thoughts. And what I have to be very honest with is my entire life. You know, of all people to do this kind of work, I would have been the perfect one. Because at the age of 5, I couldn't handle the world around me. I couldn't handle what people were telling me because I was born with synesthesia and dyslexia, and in those days nobody ever heard of those kinds of things, and so I couldn't really relate to the world around me. So what I did at the ripe old age of 5 is when I did my double-blind studies with a control group, because that's the only way I could figure out what a mud pie was, or a table was, or a tree was. I had to test it. And you know, in the first grade, and those, I'm before World War II. I'm before Pearl Harbor. And Pearl Harbor happened for me a few years before the first grade. So I'm going to the first grade, And it's a walk of death. Because in those days, they gave everybody who lost a loved one in the war effort a great big gold star decal, which you would put in your living room window so everybody would see that somebody in your family died during the war effort. So my walk to school from where I lived in downtown Twin Falls, Idaho, which is not very big, but it was a long walk to my school, it was a walk of death because most of the houses had gold stars in the window.
My. Oh,
And this one house, I'll never forget it, it had 6 new gold stars overnight.
Oh.
And I just stood there and sobbed. I kid you not, I cannot remember one morning in all of my first grade where I didn't have to quiet my sobs and stop my shutters just to walk in the door of my classroom. So, and then I wind up being a cop's kid, and, you know, and it, just a whole lot of stuff. It would take this whole show of the things that would happen because I was, you know, this very, very curious kid. And in those days, they had the old-fashioned skeleton key, you know, doorknob and the big keyhole.
Oh yeah.
And,
I
would go over to the interrogation room, door closed. Yes, but I could, see in that skeleton keyhole. And I would put my ear up there and I would listen.
Oh.
And what I would always hear, Wendy, same thing. I would always hear the person say, "Oh, I just dreamed about that last night." Or, "Oh, I just had a feeling if I opened the door, something bad would happen." Or they would say, "If I went with those people, I just had a feeling that wasn't right." And in my very objective little mind, I would reason and say, well, the dumb people, if they already know, why did they do it?
Yeah.
So I vowed that I would never be an adult when I grew up. Well, I lied. I became one.
Oh, it happens. Even our best efforts can, be derailed at that. However, you're a child at heart because you still have that curiosity, that inquisitiveness, that enthusiasm that I think is part of that inner glow, that wonder, that sense of we don't have all the answers. I have more questions. And you have certainly gone through a laundry list here of questions for a lot of people.
Yeah, still do.
The thing that you did that really started it was the book, getting back to your firsthand experience, I Died Three Times in 1977, that just happened to get itself into the right hands. But so when that happened for you, taking all of this other stuff and research aside, how did it shock, rock, change your reality?
Oh, I got a phone call. I got a phone call from Kenneth Ring. Kenneth Ring, Dr. Ring, was the man who scientifically validated the work of Raymond Moody. I'd never heard of Raymond Moody. I'd never heard of his book, Life After Life. I'd been doing my own research for over 3 years because I was told to in my third near-death experience. So I was doing what I felt God told me to do. And Ken Ring called me on the phone. He had found my book in Hartford, Connecticut. God only knows how it got to Hartford, Connecticut, because it's a little published thing, self-published.
Mm-hmm.
But he got it. And he picked it up because of the audacity of the title and the cover of the book. I Died Three Times in 1977. He said, he had to get the book, so he got the book. And he read it, traced me down by telephone, and said, I'm coming for a big meeting over Raymond Moody's place. He bought this ranch west of Charlottesville. Coming over there for a big meeting. I want to meet you. And we were living there in Harrisonburg. I said, sure. So he came over, and by golly, he stayed overnight. We talked almost all night next morning. And he said to me, he says, you're ahead of all of the rest of us. You know more than anybody else knows. He said, you have got to come up to Storrs, Connecticut. You've got to meet your peer group. You've got to see what we've done. And you've got to join the International Association of Near-Death Studies. You've got to be our columnist for our new newsletter. You've got to come aboard and cross-check your work and see if you match in any way or challenge in any way what all the rest of us are doing. Well, I didn't know there was an all the rest of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was a shock. Somebody else is doing what I'm doing? You're kidding.
Uh-huh.
And here's this college professor and psychologist who's saying to me, you know more than the rest of us. It's like, tilt.
Planet, hello, universe.
Yeah, so that was my planet, hello, universe moment, mm-hmm. with Ken Ring coming over and me being introduced to, and I've been part of IANS, the International Association of Near-Death Studies, ever since. And, he said, go over all of our archives, which I did. And he said, why don't you draw up a questionnaire for fun just to see how your people would answer it versus how our people would answer it? So I did. And that was my first of three questionnaires. And it was a shocker. It was such a shocker. Everybody answered it the same way. All they could talk about was love, 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 and how perfect life is, and how generous they were, and how service-minded and prayer and meditation, even though in my group, I knew people were having serious problems. They were having problems with depression. Their divorce was rampant. And I was looking at all this, and I was saying, wait a minute here. Something doesn't compute. It doesn't matter whether it's my group or their group, his group, their group, IN, they're all answering the questionnaire the same way.
Yeah.
And that tells me, and it's been grounded my brain again and again and again all of these decades, that the average near-death experiencer does not realize how much they have changed or how it affects other people. They just don't see it. They don't know it. It takes at least 7 to 10 years to integrate that experience before they begin to wake up. You know? And
Up
and realize that here isn't the same as there.
Integrate is a great word. It is just because you have the information doesn't mean you have any way to work through it, navigate it, manage it. It's like, oh, crap, how do I get from, because you're still, it's stuck in that little knowing phase. And it's just a way of saying, oh my gosh, everything I thought isn't real. And this is real. And it's so much better, but I'm still in the unreal place and I'm not happy.
Oh yeah, it's just a real biggie. And I could compare that to myself.
Uh-huh.
And realize that it took me 2 years before I landed.
Yeah.
No, really. Before
I
came back to Earth, it took me 2 years.
Yeah.
Just to land. You know, forget about integrating it. Just to land. And wake up and realize, whoops. You know, near-death experiencers, after their experience, all become part of or are challenged by the first rule of discipleship. And I warn everybody, the first rule of discipleship is don't freak the natives. Don't
darn
freak
it.
The natives. They'll hate you.
Oh, darn it. Yeah, I flunked that one. I thought, phooey. It's my experience, phooey. You know, and this is not a near death. It's one of the ones you call like that.
Yeah.
It's like that because
Definitely.
The whole world, it's like a Kundalini awakening, the whole nine yards.
Yeah. Right.
And that just blows everything else out of the water. And there is no one in your immediate, usually in your immediate sphere who can really, really get it when you've gone through it. The minute you come back, it's like, oh, you're on a different planet. You're on a different planet. And
you don't have words.
You
do not have words to describe anything.
And nobody believes you if you try.
Right. You're learning a whole new language. And for the benefit of your listeners, I want to make a point right now. And that is, it's getting me in a lot of trouble in this book. It's very controversial. In the book, The Near-Death Experience is the rest of the story. And especially in the second half of the book, after chapter 16, when I say, you know, the key is intensity. That's the key. Okay. What I establish in the second half of that book, ta-da, is that near-death experiences are not any kind of anomaly. They are part of the larger genre of transformations of consciousness, no matter how they occur. Be they through baptism of the Holy Spirit in church or vision quest, Kundalini breakthrough, mountaintop experience, doesn't matter what it is. What matters is the intensity. If it is intense enough, you will then begin to display the pattern of after effects. And the after effects are physiological as well as psychological. It changes your body, your brain. Mm-hmm. It changes all parts of you, not just your personality and your behavior and, you know, that kind of thing. It is a major lifetime change, and it happens to kids as well as adults, even babies being born in the birth canal. They can wow. have a near-death experience in their mother's vagina.
Uh-huh.
Wake up, world. Woohoo! A lot of cases come from birth trauma. And these little kids will remember this, of course. Most mm-hmm. of them do.
Yeah.
And when they're old enough to have language, try to tell their parents about it. The parents say, oh, shut up. But this is your imagination. I don't want to hear about it. Take it to school. Take it to grandparents, whatever. And they're just more or less slapped down. So a lot of these kids will suppress or repress or ignore or toss aside their experience. But you can't stop those after effects. You can lessen them somewhat. You can call them something else. You can deny them, but you can't stop them. And a lot of these kids grow up thinking that they're alien, they're from another planet, or, you know, it was mom or dad and they couldn't get along with them. They don't realize, nobody's saying, that if a little kid, a toddler, even up to about the age of 6, they have a near-death experience, 9 chances out of 10, they're going to lose bonding. They're going to lose the bonding to the parent. And especially the little ones, they're going to imprint to the other side, not this side.
Yeah.
So there's no wonder they grow up feeling like they're alien. Now, you can get that bonding back if the parents are smart enough to listen and to encourage the child and to work with the child. They can get that bonding back. But so many of them just plain lose it. And then, it takes the average child experiencer 20 to 40 years to integrate their experience because a child does not integrate, they compensate. You know, remember, it's the job of a child to grow up and to learn everything that they can.
Mm-hmm.
If something in their world doesn't fit that agenda, then they'll kick it out, they'll toss it, they'll ignore it, or they'll suppress it. And it just takes ever so long with kids.
I just interviewed a while back, Melon Thomas, Benedict. And he was saying, I think it was him, who was saying that he had a regression that told him or allowed him to see the abuse suffered by his mom. So he came out angry. And I'm maybe it wasn't him. I've had 2 or 3, and I remember that very clear picture.
Yeah, it was Melon Thomas. He's okay. Part of my original research base.
Yes,
and
okay.
That was part of his near-death experience. He didn't have to go be regressed for that one. That was part of his near-death experience, was seeing his father beating his mother. There was, she was pregnant, lost the baby. He just saw, and it affected him as well. He just saw a whole lot of things because, you know, in his life review, he was shown all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like George Rodanaya in his experience, and his was a very long, complex one. He was shown what happened to his parents. He was always told that. Now, George Rodanaya was a Russian, lived in Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia. He was always told that his parents died, some kind of disease or accident. Well, in his near-death experience, he went back there and he saw the KGB storming into his home. His parents barely had enough time to stuff him in a cupboard underneath the sink and shut the door. And through a crack in the door, he saw his mom and dad gunned down.
Incredible.
And so, he saw all this stuff. Well, mm-hmm. checked later on with aunts and uncles and found out that indeed was what happened. And he was never told, ever told. They did not want him to ever know. And of course, he himself was killed by the KGB. That's how he wound up having a near-death experience. He was run over. He was outside on the lawn waiting for a car to pick him up. And a car driven by the KGB just pushed him down and ran over him again and again to make sure they killed him.
Okay.
So, you know, you get into a lot of these dramatic stories. Mellon Thomas, his case is in my book, Beyond the Light. Also, mm-hmm. George Rodanaya is in the same book. And these are what I call transcendent cases. There's really four types of near-death experiences. The pattern is the same. The pattern is overall, it's global.
Hold on a second. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking near-death experiences, the rest of the story. And she's talking about four types that are global. PMH Atwater is my guest. Stick around. There's a whole lot more to come. Conscious Living, I'm Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I'm 19 years old, and this is how I live United. I've always been kind of a computer geek, and I found a way to use those skills to help the homeless in my community. For people facing hard times, computer skills and a basic resume are so important. It may seem like a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in people's lives. So with United Way, I created a program where I work with the homeless. Together, we go through their whole job history, write a resume, and then save it on their very own USB drive. We provide workbooks and training certificates. I even budgeted for cupcakes so we can celebrate as a class when one of our people gets a job. That's huge. When somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." That's what living United feels like to me. My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Romaine. As a former model, I used to walk runways all over the world. Paris, Milan, New York. This is Salif Diarra. As a local health worker, he walks the pathways of his village in Mali, West Africa, every day to help treat severely ill children. Like many children in the developing world, those in Salif's village are threatened by common illnesses that kill millions worldwide. But unlike villages without a local health worker, the children in Salif's village get the care they need to survive. And even though you can't walk in his shoes, you can help him with his work. Help one, save many. See where the good goes at goodgoes.org and find out all the ways you can help get the good where it needs to go. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
My name is Ruth Roosie. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for really? My name is Ruth Roosie. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hi there. You're listening to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett, talking with PMH Atwater about near-death experiences, the rest of the story, her latest book. She's prolific. She's written a whole lot of work on this in terms of articles and books. And what this is about this time, though, is that after 33 years of doing this research, there's a few things that she has come to know as a bigger picture about what it's about. And there's also a few things she's changed her mind about that she wrote about in three or four other books that she's now come to a different conclusion. That's what we want to find out today. So when we were, before we took the break, you had the four global commonalities, and then we also talked about transcendence. I want to give you a quick note here. I was writing for another piece, and I was focusing on, before we talked, you know, like 10 minutes or so before we talked, I was focusing on transcendence happens. And it just came that today's word is transcendence. And I thought it was so fun, you know, that these synchronicities give us, for me, little checkpoints and blueprints that say, yes, this is exactly where you're supposed to be right here now. And I appreciate you for sharing your information.
Oh, well, yeah. Synchronicity is it. I mean, it happens all the time, every day for us. You know, there it is. remember that the pattern, the general pattern of the near-death experience is global. It's just as likely to happen in the jungles of Borneo as it is in the state of Wyoming. But what I found was that within this general pattern, there seems to be four distinctive types. And the first one I call initial. And I call it initial, some people call it the non-experience, because there's very few elements to it. Something like the loving nothingness, or the friendly dark, or a special voice, or a quick in and out of body experience, or just a greeter. And that's it. Nothing else. But yet if it's intense enough, it will just completely change the individual's life. Then you've got the unpleasant, distressing, or hellish experience. No, they're not that rare. People say they're rare. They're not that rare. I truly feel that the reason we don't hear that many of them is people don't want to share them. They're either afraid to share them, or they're ashamed to share them, or for whatever reason, they don't want to talk about them. In my case, I ran across a lot of them because people felt comfortable with me, so they would tell me, you know, even these dark experiences. Then there is the pleasant or radiant or heavenly experience. That's the one we all hear about. You know, most of the TV shows are about that one, and the books, and the documentaries, and the radio shows, and on and on and on. They're about this heavenly experience. And then, last but certainly not least, the transcendent experience. You get your life reviews mostly with the hellish or heavenly, you know, the pleasant or the unpleasant. These transcendent experiences, once in a while, you'll get one with a life review, as in the case of Mel and Thomas. And with George Rodaniya, but most of the time you don't. The transcendent experience seems to address the collective, that is to say, humankind as a family, the history of humankind, maybe the history of the universe. It seems to happen mostly to those people who are willing to make a significant difference in the world when they come back because of what they saw or were told. So those are basically the four types that I have seen in thousands and thousands of cases. But, you know, an interesting thing about near-death experiences, the rest of the story, that's a summary of my work. It's the last book I'm doing on just my work as a researcher of near-death states. You know, I've been doing it for 33 years. Hey, you know, it's time to tip my hat and walk on to other things. But with that book, I then went back to the work I was doing back in Idaho before I ever died. And I was very, very active in altered states of consciousness, psychic phenomena, the transformational experience, on and on and on. Having a lot of experiences myself, but investigating other people's experiences, teaching it, bringing people to Idaho. To talk about it, I established the first Northwest Speakers Bureau on this subject, metaphysics, mysticism, established Idaho's first nonprofit metaphysical organization, and on and on and on. Thousands of people. So I went back there and brought that research and those experiences forward. And that's where, for me, I had proof positive that the near-death experience was just like a transforming spiritual experience. And again, the key is the after effects. Intensity plus the after effects. It's, you know, the after effects validate the experience, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Then you know it's real. Or the things that are happening as it's happening, you
right.
know in the reality you were in, this right. is impossible. And it's still happening.
Yeah, you got it. Absolutely, you got it.
Okay. What I like about the book, and this is in the second half of the book, and anybody who wants to read about the near-death experiences, those are also fabulous. I like the point that you do bring to the table in saying they're not all fabulous. There's a site that you can go on that talks about some of these horrific experiences that still help people to change. And sometimes they themselves say, I needed that. It was a wake-up call.
Right.
And that's important too. It's just, we're not cookie cutters. Everybody has their own unique agenda, their blueprint, the way they are motivated. And somehow there's something that knows how to motivate us really good.
You know, that's true. Well, even if you just look at the stats, we're talking general population global, worldwide, 4 to 5% are now estimated to have had a near-death experience. If you're looking at the crisis, the emergency experience, whether it be the hospital or, you know, out on the road at the accident scene, 12 to 21% average. Some people say up to 28%, but I'm sticking with the conservative because I think that's more reliable, 12 to 21%. So obviously, a lot of people are not having these. Obviously, a lot of people on the edge of death do not have a near-death experience. So when we're looking at agendas, then I'm looking at people who do have it. And you get this statement that's like an echo, thousands and thousands of cases that say, I got what I needed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you were saying, I got what I needed. So somehow, some way on the soul level or however you define higher realms or other realms, there seems to be a waveform or a rhythm to our lives. And if we get off beat, if somehow, some way, we are not developing in a way that's really beneficial for us or that it seems to accomplish what needs to be accomplished, whether for us or others, then we get a course correction. And there's lots of different kinds of course corrections. There's near-death experiences, there's Kundalini experiences, there's, you know, you can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
Somehow we get a course correction.
What I want to say real quick, I work with guides. I work with things non-physical, you know, non-corporeal being, spirit, energy. There are no perfect words for it because we still don't know what it really means. And our labels just make it more convoluted. But what I work with, I can't see. I've learned to test it, to trust it. And what I got at the beginning before it got into some really amazing transformational type stuff was judge your success and your progress by the nature of your catastrophes. When you stop creating humongous catastrophes, you'll know you're making progress.
The story of my life.
It's that thing that we give ourselves, that little, whatever it is, if it's a speed bump or if it's a cliff, we have to have something to keep us on course. And then our reaction determines the rest of it. But I like in the book where you say, we are programmed to evolve. This isn't unnatural. It is real, and it's part of our spiritual, I think, evolution of consciousness. Does that make sense?
Because that's basically even more than that. Even more than that, and I have a chapter, I think, on it, or I make this big point, and that is when I look at history, when I look at child experiencers, when I look at adult experiencers, when I look at the transformational experience, no matter how it occurs, when I look at behavior, when I'm looking at the body, the brain, cells, you know, all. When I look at the whole thing, what I'm seeing is that experiences like this literally are a biological imperative for life to exist and continuously evolve in form, capacity, and intellect towards an ever higher order. This is how the human race evolves. These experiences are a biological imperative.
What I like, too, is when you're talking about how children who have had parents who've gone through the experiences, their DNA is changed and altered. And not only that, people who are just around experiencers change in their biology and in their awareness. And that is what I think is happening on a global scale now, is that these experiencers of whatever kind of transformational event are changing and catalyzing us in our evolution.
Well, you know, that's one of those back steps I had to make, because in previous books, I've written 10 on my findings. In previous books, I've said, you know, I could not find this evolutionary element, so therefore, you know, it's not hereditary. And my work since then has proved that I was wrong. And we now, I can now give references to scientific research that show that this kind of imprinting can occur and does occur from generation to generation, and even just being around people. And, you know, it's just like, whoa. And then when I take another look, because I'm always doing this, he says, if my job is to be a synergist, my job is to look at the big picture. So when I'm looking at the big picture of these kind of experiences, every single one of them, your experience, my experience, everybody's experience, it's intense enough to be impactful. All of these experiences are threshold experiences. That's the one word applies to all of them. A threshold experience is where you are taken or flipped or forced or pushed to that edge between life and death. It's that edge of everything, the boundary between sanity and insanity. We have lots of stories and myths about it. You know, the watcher at the gate. The watcher at the gate is always fear. I don't care whether it's an animal or a person, or, you know, it doesn't matter who you meet at the gate, i.e. a greeter, if you are a near-death experiencer. That greeter is always fear. It somehow symbolizes something you have feared or something that you have accomplished, something that you now understand that you can now work through that fear. So we've got the threshold, we've got the watcher at the gate. If you go through that gate, the wonderful picture that our old Egyptian brothers and sisters gave us, remember that the scales, and one of the scales is a feather, the other scale is a heart, and you're measured at death. The idea being that if you were a good person and helped other people and were generous and kind, then your heart would weigh less than the feather, and that meant that you could go on to the higher world. But if you were not that good of a person, then you missed all the opportunities you had, or if you ruined your life, then your heart would weigh more than the feather. And then you were constrained to the lower worlds, or you would have to come back again and again to make do on all of the problems that you caused.
Clean up the baggage.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. it's the same kind of thing. Once you get through that gate, are you going to go into the higher worlds or the lower worlds, or what's going to happen to you? And I really... The picture I have is, let's just picture right now in our mind's eye that we're up there on the tippy top of this high mountain. By golly, we made it to the high mountain. You know, the spiritual experience, the high spiritual experience, we're up there at the top of that mountain, and we made it. And by golly, some fool comes up behind us and just shoves us off the mountain peak. And there we are, we're out there in air, we're out there in nothing, and it doesn't matter what you believe, it doesn't matter what you've integrated or not integrated, it doesn't matter how hot, how loud you are in calling for help, None of that matters. Nothing is going to break your fall but surrender.
Uh-huh. Surrender. I was going to say, stop the projection.
Stop the projection. Surrender. And if you surrender, all of us, every one of us, are taken to the same place. It's the same experience. We go to the same place. And that place is oneness. One God, one people, one family, one existence, one law, which is love, one commandment, which is service, one solution to all problems, which is forgiveness.
And it's incredible. It's that simple.
Yeah, it is. You know, the goal of every spiritual tradition is to release the soul from exile. The goal of a threshold experience is to reconnect the soul with Source.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I do want to get into a little part here. I love it. You include the new behaviors that come along with having these experiences. And if you're listening, you know, and you've had one, you might recognize some of these, because a lot of people, they come back and they have this tremendous sense of having something to do and having a purpose or having a connection. Not everybody. I mean, it takes a while, but your whole reality is changed. And sometimes that comes in increments and continues to build. You may have an ability to heal. You might hear music when nobody else hears music. And then the having more of a universal outlook instead of just a me, I. The silence doesn't bother you. For me, I can't function the same way if I have something that's calling my attention. So I realize how beautiful and actually full the silence is. You're not bored anymore, and you don't feel any need to compete. You allow others the chance to excel and to be who they are, and celebrate that there isn't a need for you to really interfere. And it's a whole different way of embracing life and just being here in the moment and realizing it doesn't last as long as we would like, no matter how long. But at the same time, it lasts forever in our way of remembering it. And so then you choose what you want to remember. I just, when you talk about the glow, the skin, you know, the sensitivity to light and sound, the barometric pressure. I keep telling people, well, it shifts. You know, they're there when it shifts and it does this and it does. And they're like,
and okay, electrical fine. Sensitivity, please get on my website right away. www.pmhatwater.com. Sign up for my free newsletters. I've been having newsletters since last August on electrical sensitivity. I sent one out last week also, because Ken Ring is coming back, bless his heart, and getting into electrical sensitivity, because this is so big.
Well, that's why
it's a lot bigger than most people think.
I wrote my book, Talking to Nightlights, because I called it Divine Awakening. And my editor said, no, just do Talking to Nightlights. I said, they're not going to understand. It's not the nightlight, it's the energy. So, but that's what's happened for me since 1997. It's just that interaction wherever I go. And it's a way of connecting and communicating with a higher awareness, whatever we want to call it. It isn't always the same. It's just like us. There are lots of different ways and beings that we are connected to and we're learning about. I'm so glad. What is your next? Since you said this is the last book of this series, and you're advocating this project. What
oh,
is
Oh my goodness,
what's the
Wendy.
Next step?
Wendy.
Yes,
last
you're excited.
Year when I finished the book, I thought, you know, I can say I've retired from active field work. I'm never retired from the field. I can't. I won't. But, you know, active field work and my findings and writing up all these papers and, you know, I'm free, God. I finally did what you told me to do. I'm free. I get this big vision. I mean, huge vision, bright, clear, everything defined. And I was shown the next 6 books I am to write. And I'm screaming, God, you know, I finished my work. Now I've got 6 more.
That was the warm up, okay? Now you're good warmed up.
So my next book in the new series caps off all my work on the new kids and evolution. It comes out December this year. So mark your calendar. It's called Children of the Fifth World. And we have got to look at the new kids. We've got to look at what's happening to the human family. We've got to look at the rhythm of and the time lines of what is occurring now. And we've got to be honest. Instead of this silly indigo crystal stuff, we've got to look at what's really happening to we the people, what's really happening to our children, how they are changing, and why. So the book really gets into it. It's a page-turner, and I am irreverent in the book. I'm a little bit sassy, just like the new kids are. And I'm saying, hey, we got to look at this. Folks, we have started now our second homogenesis. That is a biological shift in the entire planet.
Is that what 2020, the whole thing about 2012 is about?
Well, you know, if you go back to the indigenous cultures, they never pinpointed one day and celebrated it as happening that one day. None of them did. It was always a spread of time.
They knew better.
So 2012 covers all of 2012 and all of 2013. That's 2012. So it's a two-year span. And it's fostering and highlighting a whole litany of changes because, of course, we are now at that change period. The big, you know, universal, the cosmic year, 25,920 years. We're flipping over to the next cosmic year. Since none of us were around 25,920 years ago, we don't remember too clearly what was happening then. And now, of course, we've got more people on the planet. So God only knows what's going to happen. You know, a lot of our scientists are saying, well, you know, there's a rhythm and cycles for the weather. Yes, of course there is. Yes. But what they're forgetting is that we've got more people on the planet now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now more of a big deal than it used to be.
Kind of like having more cattle. Cattle get the bad rap and people don't.
Yeah, you know, if we look at, well, read the book, you know, Children of the Fifth World, because we've got to look at the root races, we've got to look at, you know, the grand plan, and see how it's really coming down. And
now you're just teasing. You're just teasing. Okay, did you throw any aliens in there?
Well, when that book's done, right? Okay, so this year I'm cleaning out all my files. 3 decades worth of files. What a surprise. And when all these files are cleaned up and my office is cleaned up and several things in the house are remodeled and changed and, you know, I'm really on the new path, then my first book or the next book is a memoir. And the book after that is a really big surprise. And I'm not going to talk about it.
Fine. I have to talk with you again, okay? You're just giving us little carrots, and I know it works. Near-death experiences, the rest of the story, what they teach us about living, dying, and our true purpose. You have to go to PMH Atwater's website. You have to read the book to find out more that we didn't get a chance to talk about because it's full. And if you had any kind of transcendent experience yourself, you'll find a lot of it very, very helpful and affirming. I'd love to thank you for being here and talking about this. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I'm glad the direction is calling you forward and helping everybody on the planet, not just one little segment of the population. So don't quit. I look forward to meeting you someday.
Well, you're just a huggy bear woman. I would love to just give you a big hug and let's do this again. Hey, I'm so curious. I'll always be doing something.
We will. We will stay in touch. And thank you for listening and giving your time to us today. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio.
Every day, you can help good things happen. A local health worker in Nicaragua saves one child from measles. Then she helps save three children from malaria. And 10 children from diarrhea. And 20 children from pneumonia. When you help one, you help save so many. Visit goodgoes.org to find all the ways you can help the good go further. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.